Welcome, everybody, to All About Cinema. This is Insight Podcast number 184, recording this on Friday, the 16th of September, 2011. I'm Steve Litchfield for All About Cinema, and with me in Sussex I have...
Rafe Blanford.
And up in Hull I have...
David Gilson.
There we are. Ewan's off caravanning, so we'll press on without him. A few items of news, chit-chat, analysis, starting off with Nokia Car Mode. Now, this is something I first saw in the news as Terminal Mode, which sounded very strange name, but thankfully it's been renamed as Mirrorlink, and it's a way of integrating smartphones in general, but in this case Nokia smartphones in particular, into a car sort of head system with the dashboard display. Rafe, any more details from you?
Yes, it's probably worth explaining to people that there are really two things here. There's Nokia Car Mode application, which I'll come back to in a minute, and Mirrorlink, which you're referring to there, which is, if you like, a standard, and as you quite rightly say, it was previously known as Terminal Mode. It was actually first developed in the Nokia Research and Development Labs, and as you say, what it effectively does is gives a way for a phone to be deeply integrated into a car. There's really a couple of components to that, and the most important of which really is mirroring the screen. So the screen that you have on your mobile phone will then appear on a screen in your car. You know, it's referred to as a head unit. Now, the difference to the sort of normal stuff where that might be possible, like TV out or HDMI out, is that this actually allows input from the screen back to the phone. So it'll be a touch screen on your dashboard. There'll also be buttons on the steering wheel or around the screen, you know, so accessory controls, ancillary controls that can then control stuff effectively on the head unit, but of course it's going back to the phone. So all the brains is in the phone, and there's sort of optimized things in the car, which is obviously a better approach than simply sticking your phone in a cradle and trying to use the touchscreen like that. It will also integrate into sensors of the car. So, for example, it'll use the GPS in the car, which obviously has a bigger aerial, means you don't have to have your phone somewhere on the dashboard, so it gets a good signal. It goes into speakers, microphones, so it can take advantage of the audio systems within a car. So that's all kind of the Mirrorlink technology, and that's a standard, if you will. I mean, you could see it as something akin to Bluetooth, as a way of connecting two things together. Now, to go with that is obviously the Nokia Car Mode application. This is important because you want a view on the screen that's suited to being used in the car. So generally that's going to mean bigger buttons, bigger icons, bigger on-screen controls, and maybe simplifying things down a bit so you can actually pay attention to it without crashing the car or whatever. And I should point out that the legal frameworks do vary from country to country.
I'm sure it's not advisable to play with your phone while driving in any country, we should point out.
Absolutely. But the point about Mirrorlink and this Car Mode application is to make it so you can use things and it is legal. I'm not a lawyer, so don't go out and do it right away. And you probably won't because these units aren't commercially available yet. But there's kind of a couple of main use cases. The obvious one is calling. And then there's also drive mode, which in the case of the Nokia Car Mode application is obviously based off Nokia Maps, the drive mode module of that, and also music. And so in terms of what it looks like, you've got the icons as you would see them on the phone, and they'll drop into the various functionality. In terms of the way these two integrate, Nokia Car Mode will actually start up automatically when you plug it into a Mirrorlink system, so that you won't get distracted by the usual phone interface and try and use the normal phone interface while you're in the car. Of course, this Mirrorlink stuff is fairly specialised. There's only one or two systems out there at the moment. There's actually a big motor show going on in Berlin at the moment where the first one from Alpine was announced. And if I remember correctly, the model number of that is, as he scrolls down this to find it, the ICS X8. And you can find more on that on the Alpine website, also in our story. There's probably going to be a whole load of these from different manufacturers. Alpine provides it to aftermarket, i.e. you install it in the phone afterwards. But in time, there may well be car manufacturers that have this sort of fitted as standard. Mirrorlink actually comes from the Car Connectivity Consortium, which has about 60% of the smartphone people in it and about 80% of the car market, something like that. So it's, you know, a fairly widely adopted industry standard. I think we'll be seeing a lot more of it. But for those who don't have Mirrorlink systems, which is basically everybody at the moment and the vast majority in the future, at least for a couple of years, I'd have thought, this application can be used in standalone mode. So you can just, you know, pop it into your cradle in your car. It works in landscape or portrait mode, and you get the same advantage, you know, the bigger buttons, the bigger on-screen icons, the simplified user interface, which I think is great news because it sort of makes it easier to use this in the car. It's going to be available for all Symbian Bell devices from the fourth quarter. Download it from Ovi Store. That's obviously the trio of new Bell devices, the 600, 700 and 701, but of course all the existing Symbian 3 devices will also be able to get it once they get their Bell upgrade. And just a quick Mego thing, despite the thing we're talking about Symbian, it's also going to be available on the Nokia N9.
Yeah. Although it's called MirrorLink, and of course some of these special functions like navigation and music playback and call handling get mapped through to the display and the car dashboard effectively, we should emphasise, isn't it, Rafe, that you can't, for example, play Angry Birds in this thing. Is this specific applications and specific functions only are mapped through?
Well, in theory, you could use the entire phone user interface on it. But part of the MirrorLink standard is actually sort of security controls for health and safety reasons that will prevent you using certain parts of the phone. Now, I don't know in the early systems whether it will be possible to sort of disable those and get at the original phone system, if you like. MirrorLink itself is kind of the technical bit that allows this replication to happen, and then various controls that sort of implement the health and safety bit of it, i.e., you know, not replicating the whole phone experience. In terms of the way it works, it's actually just a relatively simple VNC connection going on underneath between the phone. You plug in it to the micro USB port. Theoretically, yeah, you could use other ports. But yes, in practice, this is going to mean, in order to be legal, yes, no playing Angry Birds as you travel at 70 miles an hour down the motorway.
Oh, spoiled sport. Let's move on, though. Now, Facebook. Facebook is a completely different topic here. Facebook is something I hate with a passion. And the reason I hate it is not because of the idea of Facebook. It's because I hate the Facebook interface in a web browser. I hate the fact how complicated that Facebook make everything and how many different modules and games and options and offers and adverts. And it all just gets in the way of friends, what they're up to, and what they've been snapping, for example. So with that in mind, I have done a roundup, which you'll find on the site, just entitled Facebook on Symbian, a five-way roundup, looking at FMOBI, which is a brand new application, and Nokia Social, everyone knows and loves or hates, Borg, Facial, and Casbopus. So five different applications. And I thought just I'd summarize them briefly, but also ask around the panel and find out what you guys use for accessing Facebook. Because the interesting thing is I find these Facebook clients far more enjoyable and intuitive to use than Facebook itself, because they simplify it, because they get rid of all the distractions and just give you the people in your life and the people's updates that you want. So we've got FMOBI, very, very swish. It's a Symbian Bell-like interface, and it's very OLED-friendly, so it's white on black. A beautiful feed system and status, very, very, very good kinetic scrolling. Photos, browsing your contacts photos, really, really nice. You can zoom in, zoom out pretty fast. There's Facebook Mail, also loads quickly, and also you can get thumbnails of each CC'd recipient. It's all very, very nicely integrated. There's a nice iPhone-like home screen as well, which people will chuckle over, with sort of Anna-like icons again as well. There is a dedicated photo upload function, and the latest version has just put in thumbnails, so it's almost again like Nokia Social, which is again making FMOBI the best all-round client, because it's taken the best of all the other Facebook clients and put them all into the one application. Facial has just had a brand new release, version 3. Again, it's kinetically scrolled and OLED-friendly white on black. The big downside here compared to FMOBI is that there's only rudimentary support for Facebook Mail and messaging. So that's really a weak area for there. And also photo uploading is just used the raw file name, which is no good. But once it gets those, I think it'll be up there with FMOBI. Borg seems to have stalled rather. The developer of Borg has split it into a free version and a paid version. The paid version seems to have all the bits you wouldn't actually want anyway. So I'm not quite sure where he's going with this. If he wants to sell it and make some money, he kind of needs to hold something back that you want for the paid version. Otherwise, just go grab the free version. And that's it, version 1.44. And the big problem here is that most of the pages end up being black and white. So it's very battery inefficient. Nokia Social, you know, and love, I'll skip over that. It hasn't really improved very much with the recent minor versions, but still does the job for most people without who aren't Facebook and Twitter power users. Finally, Casbopus had a few recent updates, very much black on white backgrounds, very OLED unfriendly, and it seems to be quite a few functions still missing from that, but it shows promise, and the interface is certainly quite responsive. Having said all of that, I don't use any of these for Facebook. I use Gravity. Because all I want really from Facebook is to see what my friends are up to, see their status updates, and to be able to put in brief comments, and also to upload my own photographs, for example, and say what I've been doing so people can comment on that. And I don't, if I want anything more than that, yes, maybe I'd use FMobi, but most of the time I, Gravity does everything I want. David, how do you use Facebook on a mobile?
Very little. I'm not really a fanatic Facebook user. I'll maybe look at Facebook once or twice a day, and most of the time that'll be on the desktop. I'm like you, I will just skim through updates on Gravity, because Gravity isn't a great interface for Facebook, but it does all I want to do, because I just want to see status updates, just see if there's anything important going on with my friends that I should know about. And other than that, I'm not really doing a lot with Facebook at all. So, although having said that, sometimes if there's something I absolutely have to do on the mobile that I can't do on Gravity, I will go into Opera and run Facebook in the browser.
Okay. Rafe, how do you use Facebook, if at all?
Well, I do tend to use it a little bit on the desktop, and on the mobile side of things, it tends to be more a way of filling in a bit of time to try and catch up with feeds. I mean, I do use FMobi, and I've been impressed with kind of the speed of the development, how that's gone from, you know, early stages to something that's really quite mature and very slick now. I mean, it's almost got to the point where it's far more than I ever really need, but I do appreciate the fact that it's a lot of love and attention has gone into it. I like the fact it's using the Bell UI, and it's a good example of, you know, how actually a Symbian phone can feel really up to date with a top class application that people sometimes, you know, overlook. So I think it also shows promise for what Bell might do in general. Looking at some of the other ones, I've tried most of these at one point or another, if only out of curiosity. But I will admit, Nokia Social is something I still use, partly because of the integration of the photo uploading, if I want to do something direct from the camera. But I have to admit, that's probably the only time I use it, because the rest of the time I do find it a bit on the slow side. And I have been a Casper Plus user for quite some time, mainly because it just offers the basics and does those very well with a nice-looking user interface. In terms of, you know, like you, just looking for the status updates, and then, you know, very simple stuff. And I have
you can see why I voted it with the lowest score in my roundup, though.
I can. I mean, it doesn't have the same functionality as the other Facebook applications. But then I think when you're asking what Facebook application do you want to use, you do need to ask yourselves, you know, what are the functions that are important to me on the mobile device? Because sometimes less is more, and I think that applies a lot for mobile. And for the same reason, actually, the mobile Facebook website can also be quite good to use. I mean, it's also, I probably shouldn't admit to this, but I've switched a device and I haven't got the client I want installed. And so sometimes I'll just pop over to m.facebook.com, and that will get me the information I need. Because sometimes I'm looking up, I don't know, it's something like I'm going to an event and the information somewhere on Facebook, and it's just easier to find it in that way. And yes, I should have written it down or put it into my calendar, but I'm not quite living the smartphone lifestyle as I always should do. But like the rest of you, I suspect I probably use Facebook more on the desktop when I should probably be working hard on a review or doing something.
Absolutely.
When I just need 5 minutes to distract myself. I'm not a core Facebook user, but I will say that I've been using MSN Messenger for testing reasons. And actually, that's got Facebook integration that works pretty well for seeing status updates on the desktop. So it's kind of effectively a desktop client for Facebook. And similarly, you know, the TweetDeck can also fill in that functionality role as well, a bit like it is for you on Gravity on mobile. And yes, I have Facebook connected to Gravity on my devices as well. I tend not to use that. I'm not quite sure why. Perhaps it's sort of, there's so much information when I get into Gravity, I tend to focus on the Twitter stuff there.
Yeah. We should, of course, note that the Windows Phone, which is Nokia moving towards through 2012, 2013, has Facebook very much front and centre in terms of integration. So a lot of this talk of Facebook clients will rather go away.
Yes, I mean, and the interesting thing about that is actually connected to the kind of the people hub. So imagine it's in your contacts application. We already have this on the Symbian device, as sort of very basic status information will sometimes appear in the address book. And I think that's been very limited. And we've talked about the social address book, and Windows Phone, as Steve says, goes a lot further. And actually I found, because I've been using a Windows Phone device alongside my E6, probably for fairly obvious reasons, as people can work out, making sure we're familiar with this stuff. And I've actually found seeing the sort of status update appear before you call someone or when you're looking up information about a person, I think I may end up using it more that way. It's very difficult to say because usage patterns do tend to change. But it'll be interesting to hear from people who are really regular Facebook users and who are maybe bigger users of the service than the three of us on this podcast, and to which you prefer. So do let us know in the comments.
Yeah, I felt a bit sorry for you, Rev. You'd, on the first version of my Facebook client roundup, you'd done some immaculately prepared videos of demonstrating the interface of each application. And one thing that's been common to all of these Facebook clients is they radically change their interface from version to version, and I mean radically. So it makes it a complete mockery of doing a video. So I had to axe your videos and replace them by static screenshots, which do at least...
And we should actually compliment all the authors here, because there's been a very regular pace of updates on almost all of these applications. And they each do different things and have different ways of doing it. So I love the fact that there's a lot of choice here. But I also love the fact they seem to be very responsive to their user base. So I know quite a few of these applications have, you know, pages on Facebook itself where they're regularly interacting with people. So if you're looking for a particular feature or you don't like something, it's well worth checking out the author's Facebook page or the equivalent elsewhere, and so giving your feedback, because they've been very responsive. And I think it's a great example of sort of user-centric development, you know, where they've iterated over time, and I think a lot of developers could learn from that.
Yeah, we should just of course plug the fact that All About Symbian has a Facebook page, and it's just All Space About Space Symbian, is it?
No, it's facebook.com/allaboutsymbian should get you to it.
Okay, it's very neat. There's also, I should just plug my phone's show chat podcast, which also has a page there, which I've been trying to promote. And I've even got NFC tags to promote, which I've been using, testing with my various NFC-enabled phones, either the C7 and the Nexus S. But we're more on, I say, keep plugging this, near-field communications coming soon to All About Symbian over the next month or so. Let's move on. Nokia has announced that the Qt project, the open... governance work started June 2010, that's just over a year ago, I guess, will finally go live on October the 17th, 2011. Rafe's got the details.
Yes, this is the Qt project, which is really a result of the open governance discussion that's been going on within Qt for some time now. It sort of dates back really to the summer of last year. It's taken maybe a little longer to implement than people were expecting. But how to explain this succinctly? Well, Qt has been open source for a long time. But there is open source as in the code, but there's also open as in the governance or the way the project is run. And this is really what the Qt project is a sort of fulfillment of. And what's going to happen is, rather than being controlled previously by Trolltech and then obviously when Nokia bought it by Nokia, the governance will actually go to the people who are contributing to the code. And this is in the form of the various people who take on the roles. In the case of Qt, they're being talked about as contributors, approvers, and maintainers. And that's roughly an order of seniority in terms of contributors, people contributing code, maintainers, people maintaining the code in a specific area. And approvers are actually the people sort of ticking off contributions, if you will.
This is all sounding very similar to the Symbian Foundation model, Rafe. It's just kind of sounding worrying warning bells in my mind. How similar is it?
I think people will make that comparison just because of the Nokia names involved, but I actually think the two are very different. With the Symbian Foundation, actually the governance was relatively closed. It was done through various committees, and there was sort of appointed heads. But in reality, it was tightly controlled by the handset manufacturers, and in particular Nokia. You couldn't do anything without their implicit, their approval, if you like. With Qt, the difference is it's been open source for a long time, and the actual governance model is very different. It is genuinely open. Now, Nokia is the major contributor and therefore will take up the majority of these slots for contributors, approvers and maintainers. But there is at least the possibility of that changing. And I think it's important to realise that people working on the project in Nokia are actually going to be working on it as an upstream project. And so everything will be happening out in the open. That was theoretically the case in the Symbian Foundation. In practice, it didn't work like that. Nokia was maintaining its own branch of the Symbian code and effectively dumped it to the Symbian Foundation every now and then. And that's obviously not what should be happening in an open source project. So I don't think you can really compare the two. I mean, Nokia perhaps has a bad name in open source after what happened to the Symbian Foundation, but we've discussed before that was more about the technical challenge of Symbian rather than the specifics of the open source and the governance. So I think this is good news for Qt, because actually it means that there are possibilities for the future outside of, you know, direct Nokia control. And certainly if you're using Qt outside the handset space, this is good news, because you can get some input into the project in terms of getting your contributions accepted and you know, at least a say in where the project is going next, and that's going to be important as Qt 5 comes along. For Nokia, you know, this isn't sort of we're getting rid of Qt, this is actually a way of sort of handling the asset in the that will benefit them in the best possible way. They've said, you know, we've talked about it before, that they want to use Qt for the next billion, which is Qt in the next generation of Series 40. So they're going to continue to make big investments, and they'll be pushing it that way. But there'll be other contributors, you know, especially from KDE coming in from the desktop and others like that, and particularly in embedded systems as well. I suspect we might see Digya active there, which will sort of take it in different directions. So all the result of all of this is that effectively the hosting of Qt will move to a new domain name, qt-project.org, and that will happen, as you say, on October 17th. That's just before the Qt developer days. I mean, I think from a Symbian point of view, this probably isn't quite so pertinent as people might think, really, because Qt on Symbian is going to be about Qt 4.7.x, and is likely to remain that way for the rest of the life of Symbian. This open governance and the Qt project is really going to impact more on Qt 5 and subsequent versions. I mean, you're going to get the bug fixes sure coming in, but I think they would have happened from Nokia anyway. But what this does mean is it, I think, gives Qt a much healthier future in the longer term. Nokia are obviously going to use it on Series 40 in kind of their quasi-smartphones, feature phones, which I'm sure we'll talk about in the future. And it's also obviously still being used by Symbian. It's going to be used by MeeGo as well, is being used by MeeGo. And there's also quite a lot of possibilities for the future. I think people have tended to thought of Qt as belonging to Nokia, but actually some of the uses outside of Nokia are probably more widespread and better known. You just don't realise it in terms of its use in Linux as a desktop. I'm sure David could talk about that, as well as I say, in embedded systems, in all kind of printers. And I think there's a lot of future in that particular area.
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, I'm quite optimistic for how the Qt project looks to be managed at the moment. I mean, it does have a lot more experience in the open source world than Symbian did, because, of course, it came from Trolltech, and it's the framework that the KDE desktop is based on. People may not have heard of KDE, but this is a desktop environment for Linux and Unix, etc. And if the KDE project have their way, it'll also be an alternate desktop for Windows. I read about the hierarchy of users, contributors, approvers and maintainers earlier in the year. And I think it actually sounds quite good, because it, I mean, obviously time will tell how it goes, and we're on the outside looking in. But it doesn't look to be that there's an overbearing amount of bureaucracy involved in it. And it actually looks like the people who are motivated and thus active in the project will float to the top and be able to guide and look after the project, which is exactly the right sort of people you want to be doing that.
Yeah, I mean, there's no easy recipe for opening governance for an open source project, but I do think the right approach is being taken. And from a strategic point of view, I think it makes sense for Nokia, because they will get these outside contributions in, and really, you know, they want to see Qt really as an enabler or as a tool set. And if they can encourage external adoption, that will only help them. I mean, in terms of talking about the metrics, so far about 15% of the maintainers, contributors and approvers are non-Nokia people now. I suspect a lot of those are going to be from companies like Digya that have significant Qt investments already. There's some in North America, and indeed a few individuals as well. And they'll look to increase that over time to sort of, if you like, widen the base in terms of the companies contributing. But as David says, I think the proof will be in the pudding, but certainly the ingredients look like they've got them right this time round. So we'll keep an eye on it, because obviously it does have implications for the future, particularly with regard, I think, to Series 40, MeeGo. And Symbian, well, we do have a shelf life on that, and I suspect the importance there will be less felt. But Qt will probably play a bigger role in Nokia's future than most people imagine, so we'll certainly be keeping an eye on it.
Yeah. Or something else we've been keeping an eye on. This was announced 2 years ago now. We're recording this in late 2011. Late 2009, Nokia Mobile Money was announced, powered by as OboPay, for developing countries. This is a fascinating concept, Rafe. You've got people in developing countries who have no credit card, they have no bank account, and no computer. All they've got is a phone, and yet this is a system that enables them to transfer money to other people, to pay bills, and to recharge pay-as-you-go the credit on their very phone they're using, all over the phone, all via SMS, all via this new client. And I did link across to a nice article by Atif Sumar over on the CJ's blog, which goes into the client, which is basically based in Java, but there do seem to be some Symbian components, and they include lots of screenshots of how it all works. Is this too late, Rafe, or is it still early days for the developing world, do you think?
It's still very much early days. I mean, I think you could compare this to mobile payments on NFC, in that it's very much its time is yet to come. Mobile money, or Nokia mobile money, is particularly interesting because, as you say, it's focused on the unbanked, and that's people who don't have bank accounts. And particularly in emerging markets, that's a very sizable portion of the market. And I don't think you need to be a genius to work out anything that involves transferring money around the place has real potential in the future, you know, because obviously it's just like the credit card system. You can take a small transaction fee off the top. And so for the company that gets this right and, you know, really establishes a big system, I think the benefits could be enormous. However, this thing takes so long to implement because obviously the legal frameworks involved in setting up banks and transferring money around are very significant indeed, and they vary from country to country. And this is one of the reasons why Nokia is partnering with different companies. You mentioned OboPay. They're involved in some of the kind of infrastructure, but they're also partnering with banks. So there's a couple of banks in India doing this. They're going to expand it as they can to other countries. And, you know, systems like this are in place elsewhere. There's a few African countries where kind of paying for things with mobile money in the form of either top-up cards or sending SMS is a little bit more common because you can effectively transfer the balance of your credit on your pay-as-you-go mobile phone. Nokia Money is more directly concerned with an actual account and sort of monetary transfer. And, you know, the idea is that you can then take the money out of your account as you would for any other bank account. It's not quite the ATM system. I think the way this will be working is that you'll go to existing sort of Nokia dealers in India. Nokia has many points of sale, and you'll be able to, you know, take your device along and extract money. Now, obviously, there's potential for this to develop in all sorts of ways. But yes, I think this is actually, you know, the significance of this is massively underrated, because if you establish yourself as a player in this market, really, it's a whole new industry outside of sort of the traditional mobile phones for Nokia. And, you know, I think establishing that kind of trust relationship, you know, obviously has big implications. You know, I think something like this could potentially provide far more lock-in than any other service I can think of. You know, if you think about the loyalty of people to bank accounts, I mean, that's part of around the hassle with changing into a different system. So I do think this is enormously significant. And although you know, in the Western markets, but in the UK, the US, anywhere in Europe, we'd probably be scratching our head, what's the point in this? You go, actually, you have to sort of put it in its context to understand its significance. And of all the sort of things that Nokia is involved in, I think this is one of the most interesting. You know, it's sort of something in the same regime as Life Tools, which was a way of getting agricultural data to farmers from the market very easily, and various other bits of data. Similarly, the education programs that Nokia has, particularly with Pearson in China and Reuters as well, are really very interesting just because of the scale that they could potentially operate on. And, you know, they could in time spread to other markets. And, you know, Nokia Money as a brand, I think, has a lot of potential in India just because it's associated with Nokia, which is the number one brand in India. So yes, definitely keep an eye on this one, even if it, I think, is probably for the time being going to be more focused, as I say, in places like India and on the lower cost devices rather than necessarily the smartphones. Because as you say, it's done with text messages, so it's using very simple technology. It's not really doing anything particularly fancy in technical terms. There's all the back-end infrastructure that's complicated in legal terms and all of that. So yeah. And it's definitely go and read the article on, oh my God, it's CJ, the website, because he's done a great job sort of summarising and showing screenshots of how it all works.
I was looking at this and I think my first thought is, oh, well, this is very much like PayPal. This is how I would like to use PayPal. And then, of course, that's me stuck in my Western world way of thinking, because, of course, PayPal does depend on bank accounts, whereas this doesn't. Yeah. I'm just curious and wondering, I mean, whether people will use it for like just quick payments, they'll go somewhere, hand some cash over and get their phone topped up, or whether they will actually try and obviously you're not going to earn any interest, but whether they will actually try and keep all their money in digital form on Nokia Money.
I think this is really a way of turning money into a digital form that's then easy to pay things with. So I would see this more as akin to a credit card kind of mechanism, because if you don't have a bank account, you don't have debit cards. It's obviously pretty hard to get hold of a credit card as well. And going to pay your telephone bill or your ISP bill, your utilities bill, or whatever it happens to be, in cash is a bit annoying. You can imagine if you know you had to pop off to BT every month to go and pay your bill. I don't think it will necessarily displace things in retail shops where you're handing it over and getting a physical good, but for services and virtual goods it makes a lot of sense. And the thing, I mean, I've spoken to various Nokia executives about this, including some of the ones behind Nokia Money, and by far away the harder thing to do is trying to get yourself into the right mindset of understanding this when it's not in your own market, because you know it's difficult to imagine what it's like. And you can talk about it in abstract and go, yes, I can see the point of it, but actually the difference it could make in people's lives I think is quite substantial. It will take time before those benefits really come on stream for the people who could benefit from it most. At the moment I think probably it's more of technical interest than anything else, but as things develop I think that will very much change. So it is more potential at the moment than actual things, but yes, if you think about it as a way of providing you with a bank account and for being able to pay for services, that then opens up those services to people who may not have had access to them before. As I say, it has some really interesting implications for the way society might develop, and for the potential for development in general in those countries. And of course you have to be careful when you're talking about this, because you don't want to come across as a arrogant Westerner saying, well, this is what it's going to be used for. And I think it will find its own level. I think it enables things, and then we'll actually have to wait and see which ways it's used. And one thing you do learn about technology is quite often they're used for things that you never imagined in the first place, and I think that will certainly apply here.
I think there is a use case in Western countries as well. If you think about people who are homeless or for whatever reason not in the main flow of society and trying to get back in, I mean, it does seem that these days, no matter how little money you've got, people seem to always end up with a mobile phone. And people who don't have a fixed address, who need some way of handling money, that Indian context that we've been talking about could very well apply to people here as well who are disadvantaged.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And I shouldn't say it's not relevant to the West, because obviously it could become a secondary form. And as I say, I wouldn't be surprised if it linked up with NFC in terms of the future and maybe the branding of it. The way it's working may not be quite the same, but obviously anything that makes it more convenient as a monetary instrument is a good thing. I just think probably the demand for it will be less, simply because there are other systems already in place. And that doesn't mean those systems might not come out in other countries as well. But I do think this plays into the strength in terms of, as David was saying there, everybody having a phone, relatively simple technology in terms of SMS and things like that. So it can go anywhere. And we've already, we talk about this more generally when Nokia talk about connecting the next billion. It's an abstract concept in one sense, but when they're talking about connecting the next billion people to the internet, with all of that it implies, these things, could have massive impacts on society and the way people do things. And it is very difficult to sort of get your head around it and appreciate the full implications. So Nokia Money, it's not really related to Symbian directly. It's not into smartphones. But I do think it's one thing that's worth paying attention to, simply because of the massive impact it could have. And I hope it will have. Whether it's Nokia Money or someone else is kind of irrelevant. But in terms of, the potential for change, I do think this is really, really interesting.
Of course, it is fully compatible with all the Symbian devices, but on the grounds that it says part Java, part Symbian, and it was demonstrated in the article, I think, on an E61 or E61i. So there is a Symbian angle there.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out that this is also deliberately compatible with all the non-Nokia handsets as well. That's something that Nokia deliberately wanted to do. They're actually trying to be as agnostic as possible. When I first talked to them about this, they were saying how really it's going to be a layer that enable things, and regardless of whether that's between different devices, but also on the other end, it doesn't matter which bank is backing it. What they want to do is have a recognizable way of doing things. The Nokia brand obviously has a strength there, but it doesn't matter what device you use. It doesn't matter what bank is on the back end, the fact is it's enabling access to a digital form of currency, and obviously the implication of being able to pay for anything with that.
Yeah, it's a nice vision, really. I just picture this of some guy in rural India or, you know, somewhere in Asia, and he's got an E61, a battered old E61 that's worth about, I don't know, £10 on the Western European second-hand market. But he's managed to get this E61, S63rd edition. It's probably one of the slowest Symbian phones ever made. But for him, it is his only computer. It's his lifeline to the internet, to lifeline to basic messaging and email. And now it's possibly his lifeline to sending money around and paying bills and charging up his phone credit. And this is his only computer, this one little E61 with its QWERTY keyboard and Corda VGA screen. It's rather a wonderful, wonderful vision of how things can be facilitated in developing countries. So credit all round, really. We are out of time, though. Ewan's off caravanning. You'll catch him next week. In the meantime, though, it's goodbye from Rafe.
Goodbye, everybody. Thanks for listening.
And goodbye from David.
Goodbye, everybody.
And a goodbye from me. Remember to catch us All About Symbian on Facebook, also allaboutsymbian.com, also @AAS on Twitter. We'll catch you next week.